Morning, everybody, and thanks to Adam for the great songs in which he has led us today. I'd like to ask you to join me in a word of prayer before we get into our reading of the Lord's Word today. Father, thank you so much for these dear people who are gathered around today. Please help us all to be impressed with Jesus for these next few minutes. So much so that we consider the impact he must have in our lives. We ask this in his name. Amen. This is a part of a series in which we've been involved for a month now in considering the ministry of Jesus, the different aspects of the Lord's work. I'd like to ask you to think for a moment of what the people are most interested in who are around during the ministry of the Lord, and what does he think they are least likely to grasp the meaning of? In fact, we could expand it to even now. What do people know most about Jesus but think about the least, the meaning of? And I think the answer in each case is the same. The signs that the Lord did. A lot more people know that Jesus walked on the water than have ever taken to heart what that might mean. Think about the word signs. This is the term that the Gospel of John uses consistently for the mighty works of Jesus. John refers to the things the Lord does always by this term, with the exception of the word wonders. One time it's translated miracles in the King James, but always signs. A sign is something that points beyond itself to what is far more important than it is. It points to something of greater significance than the deed or the event that has happened. When a mighty work is called a sign, the idea is that this event is something way more weighty. It points to something way more weighty than just that event that has occurred. One writer says it this way: none of the miracles of Jesus were kind actions to alleviate human distress and nothing more. And if we forget that, then we end up wondering why the Lord sometimes hesitates to do these signs and why he didn't do them for everybody all the time. The signs Jesus did mean not only that he is from heaven, but also that heaven is calling on us. Each one of these signs, in some way or another, is a cry from heaven for our hearts. Last week we pointed out that Jesus had a heart for the work. His signs that he does question whether we have hearts for him and hearts for heaven. We'd like to ask you to consider how that's so this morning, and let's take the time to sort of read our way through the accounts of the seven signs that John records so that we may believe. These stories will be, these accounts will be familiar to each of us, and they all have many lessons that we won't have time to stop and get at. But when you look at all of them together, and when you consider them as heaven calling us, they look different. And that's the sense in which we consider them today. There are seven of them. They start in John chapter 2. The first of them is the changing of water into wine of the best quality. Quality is the key word here. And don't get sidetracked. We realize that there were the word for wine was used in different ways in Palestine of that day. But the point is here, the Lord's power, it's at a wedding feast. And a wedding feast was the most important social occasion in life for the people of Jesus' time and where he lived. His mother was at this wedding feast. It's about 8 or 10 miles from where Jesus grew up. It is a feast that would last about a week, and everybody in town would be invited to it, and the host would provide. The way he provided food and drink for that occasion indicated the value that he placed on the wedding, but also on his community and on the people who are present. In this case, they run out. The Lord's mother comes to him. Jesus and at least 5 of his disciples are there, and she simply says to him, they've run out of wine. The implication may be that part of the reason they've run out is because Jesus and his disciples are all there too. And after him pointing out to her that he is more concerned about his hour, and John, his hour is the hour in which he will suffer, in which he will confront the one who has the power of death and take the keys away from him. That's what Jesus has come for. But in John 2, his mother simply says to the others, do whatever he tells you. That's her confidence in him. And now beginning at verse 6. Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification. That's how they washed their hands or washed the utensils and so forth. Each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. And when the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. Jesus has taken lack and turned it into quality. He has provided what has run out. In order to prove that what was in those jars was water, he had them all filled to the brim. And then I take it at least that when water is drawn out from them and carried to the master of the feast, by the time it gets there, he has changed it into wine. The point of this is the Lord's hour that he's concerned about, and then what we read in verse 11. This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. His mother is interested in supplies at a wedding feast. He is interested in whether he will get to his hour and have disciples who will still believe that he is the good part, that he offers the good part in life so that they will stay with him and they'll have faith enough for that. Look to the next one of the signs. In John chapter 4 now, we're back at Cana again. And Jesus has been to Jerusalem and Judea in between and has done things there. But it says now, verse 48, so he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum is about 25 miles away now from Cana, there was an official. The official, called a nobleman in some of the translation, may have been an official in the household of Herod the Tetrarch. an important man, an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. What would you have to think in order to leave your son when he's at the point of death and make a journey of 25 miles to ask Jesus this? So Jesus said to him, unless you, the you here is plural, see signs and wonders, you will not believe. It's sort of a challenge. Has word got back to you of what we've done? And if you, are you just here because of the sign? The official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. What a plea, a pitiful one that is. Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. Think of what kind of choices would have run through this man's mind at that point. Do I get up and go without him? I came after him. Do I question what he's telling me? And if I do, will that mean that I think he's not able? The wonder is this fellow, the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. And as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them what hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. The man knew that that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. He himself believed in all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. The man believed the word that Jesus told him in verse 50. He believed with all his household when he realized that the boy had been made well at the very moment Jesus had told him his son would be well. Jesus has healed the boy from a great distance in this situation, showing not only power over the illness, but also power that transcends distance and time. The third sign is in John chapter 5. There's a feast of the Jews. We don't know which one it is, and Jesus is now back in Jerusalem. So at chapter 5 in verse 2, we read, now there was in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool. In Aramaic or Hebrew, it's called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. That seems to be an important feature of this story. And in these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. John explains the idea that people had, the belief that they had, that when the water stirred in that pool, whichever one of them could get in it first would be healed. John doesn't endorse that idea, but that's what he says they thought. And so at verse 5, one man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to be healed? The sick man answered him, sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm going, another steps down before me. It's almost a form of it's somebody else's fault. Jesus said to him, get up, take up your bed, and walk. And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now, Jesus picks this guy out of the multitude of needy folks who are there and asks him if he wants to be made well. That's an amazing question if you think about it. Is Jesus indicating that this guy has been there so long that he's now been affected psychologically so that he blames other people and feels sorry for himself and makes life that way. I think it's a possibility that that's the case. In verse 14, notice that afterward, after this is all done, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." Jesus is interested in something more than the lame man's paralysis or even his psychological condition. He's interested in rescuing him from the worst fate, which would be for his sin to have an impact on him forever. In John chapter 6 now, the fourth of these signs occurs. Jesus has shown himself to be the master of quality and of distance and of time, as well as disease, and now of supply. In John chapter 6, he's teaching at the Sea of Galilee, and he sees a large crowd following him because they saw the signs he was doing. He went up to the mountain to teach them, and he lifts up his eyes and sees this large crowd coming toward them. Look at verse 5. Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 days' wages worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so that the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he did, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world." You can see the wonder of the supply that the Lord provides when they lacked quantity. From 5 little rough barley pancakes and a couple of pickled fish, small fish, the Lord feeds 5,000. But he's not interested only in their eating bread and fish. And I know that because as this story unfolds and they start looking for Jesus and for more of these signs, he makes the point to them in verse 35, "I'm the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst." What he wanted them to do is to ask, "Who is this? What does this mean? Wouldn't you be more interested in the one who could feed people like this than you are in the food?" The next one of the signs follows closely this one. It's in John chapter 6, verses 16 beginning. Now it's the Lord's mastery over natural laws by walking on the water against the wind. Verse 16, "When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum, a distance apparently of around 7 miles. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them." The other accounts tell us he was on the mountain praying. "The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. And while they had, when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, and if you figure this up, they've been trying for about 9 hours. And if you can picture them with their backs against the wind, trying to pull the rows, the oars, and if you've ever done anything like that, how it might have burned on their backs, they saw Jesus walking on the sea, walking toward them, if you can imagine this, and coming near the boat, and they were frightened, I'd say. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. The storms that so easily frighten, and the difficulty that we encounter while we're trying to do what the Lord asks us to do, he shows himself to be the master of in this event. John chapter 9 is the next one of these, the opening of the eyes of a man who has been blind his entire life from the day that he was born. When this account begins, you'll notice that they walk by with the disciples and they see this fellow, and the disciples are interested in why the guy has suffered this misfortune. Is it because of something his parents did? Or is it because of something the man did? In verse 3 beginning, Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it's day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said this, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which meant sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. That simple action was an undeniable wonder because everybody knew this guy. And it set off a discussion about whether it was right for Jesus to do this on the Sabbath day. The man confesses that this is the prophet. Then he confesses that he's from God. Then he confesses that he believes he's the Son of God, and he worships him like one might if he realized what had been done. And quickly, the other one of these signs is the most astonishing of all, the raising of Lazarus from the tomb where he had been for 4 days. The way in which this unfolds proves, I think, that Jesus is looking for something more than just the sign to be done. He wants his disciples to be able to believe that he'll be able to overcome the grave himself. And he wants people to have reason to believe. And you remember the story of his coming back to Bethany and meeting Martha and then meeting Mary and making himself known as the resurrection and the life, weeping with Mary, being so moved by what they were going through. But verse 38 says, "Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, 'Take away the stone.' Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there'll be an odor, for he's been dead 4 days.' Jesus said to her, 'Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?' So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me.' When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out!' The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Would you have walked up and started taking the grave clothes off? It says that many of the Jews, therefore, who came with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. In this case, Jesus shows himself to be the master of not only time, but also of death itself. I want to take a moment, although only have a moment, to ask you to consider three principles for our lives from these signs. The first one is that the Lord, in doing these things, wanted and even expected people to think enough to draw adequate conclusions about the meaning of these signs and the application of what the signs mean. To just see the signs or to benefit from them, like having food given to them, was not the kind of thinking that Jesus is requiring of people. Instead, it's, who could do something like this? What's my proper relation to him? How does what he's done change what matters to me? That's the kind of thing that the Lord is after. He wants them to make the application. The Lord doesn't have to have called a topic by name or to have identified a specific sin that's being corrected or to have made three points about it, to have taught a truth that's to be understood and used. A second principle is that each of these mighty works of Jesus is in some way heaven not only confirming who he is, but also calling in a way that reveals who I am and who you are. These are demonstrations of what Jesus is to the life of any person, demonstrations that are powerful enough in their implications to express judgment upon us as either being receptive to life or against life. These, if you put all of these together, just think of what we're being told. Jesus is the source of the good in life. He's the Lord of everywhere and all the time. He's the deliverer from the worst fate. He's the provider of the deeper need. He's the ruler of all nature. He's the master of misfortune. He's the one who has the keys of death itself. And really, we're being told that the dividing line of reality is here. Not in our preference or our opinions or our ideas or our conceptions, but in whether I believe that Jesus is all of this, for I reject it. And that's what shows my true condition as a person. There are verses in these accounts that we could read that show that, but the end of chapter 9, I suggest, is the best, verses 39 and 40. Then a third principle. The concept of belief that's indicated in the Lord's dealings with people in these events fits with the purpose of the events and is still the point of their being recorded. Did you notice as I read, or as you think back on those scenes, what happens? The Lord gives the instruction, draw some out and take it to the master. Go, your son will live. Get up, take up your bed and walk. Have the people sit down. Go wash in the pool. Take away the stone. And these people's lives, and still in ours, the Lord blesses while believing action is occurring. He blesses people while they are doing. just as he says, just because he's the one who says it. These changes take place while people are acting on what Jesus has said. Belief, someone observed, is not confined to one occasion or one type of work, but it involves utter confidence in Christ as a person who can be trusted with the dearest treasures and the deepest problems. I like that obligation. And I think that's the reason for the variety of the signs John has recorded for us. Somebody said, there is no defense as adequate as truth. While I appreciate the ones who can go around and use science or history or things like that as evidence, I don't want us to ever forget that the signs Jesus did during his ministry are his defense for offering himself as the way to heaven. These are the things Jesus does to call on our hearts to be receptive to what he is offering. When we get to the end of John, John tells us that many other signs were done by Jesus in the presence of his disciples, but that these are written so that we may believe, and that believing we may have life in his name. These things tell us there is enough reason to believe, and that Christ is enough to give us life. At the end of Luke, the focus is on repentance. At the end of Matthew and Mark, the focus is on believing and being baptized. These are not opposite things or different things. They're a part of the same kind of response, which is willing to depend on Christ and his work for life. We invite and encourage every one of us to let that be our confession today and the one that we keep every moment along the way. If we can assist you in so doing, let us know of your need by coming here to the front while we stand and sing.